And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Darlene Bungy. Darlene has previously written two biographies, both about Australian artists. These were the award-winning Arthur Boyd, A Life, and in 2015, John Olson, An Artist's Life, which won the Prime Minister's Literary Award. And now Darlene has produced for us Daddy Cool, Finding My Father, the singer who swapped Hollywood fame for home in Australia, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. Darlene, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
So, darling, you wrote those biographies on Australian artists, Arthur Boyd and John Olson. Was it different to write about your own father?
It was easier. Just my sister and I now survive, and it was my sister that I had to check everything with, and she was absolutely wonderful and pressed me to be as frank as possible. And with the other two biographies, you always sort of feel a cuckoo in somebody else's nest because you end up sometimes knowing more of the history about the family than anyone in it because you talk to so many different people. So it was, in the end, a lovely thing for me to do, to feel closer to my father and to understand him a little better.
Yes, and well, your sister is also an accomplished author as well, isn't she?
So it's extremely, quite... yes, a Pulitzer Prize winner, yes.
So yes, a very
Geraldine Brooks. I'm sure everybody has heard of her.
Yeah, so a very successful family in lots of ways. So now the title "Daddy Cool" was that perhaps part of the language in the 40s and 50s?
Well, yes. I think it was the 30s. I found an article with my father looking drop-dead gorgeous with his slick back hair and a white tie and a black shirt, and he did look extremely cool. And he was speaking the idiom of the time, which became part of our language now, but, you know, calling the musicians gates and swingers and jam sessions and all that sort of thing. It was the new language, and he was written up in the press for speaking it and nobody sort of understanding it at the time.
Yes, well, I think it's since got into our language, and there's been a more recent pop group and song called Daddy Cool, so we can all identify with the title anyway.
Yes.
Now, now that you've written this book about your father, do you somehow feel a bit closer to your father? I mean, he died more recently. He was born in 1907. But sometimes you feel closer to a parent after they've actually died. Does that come across to you?
Well, I think, you know, particularly when we're adolescents, we don't listen enough. And, you know, we get very bored of hearing about the past. But writing this book, the first half of it, I discovered my father as a child and then as a teenager and then as a young man. And it was a lot of research. But as I discovered more things, I realized how he had suffered so much, and obviously that had impacted on later life. And I understood him a great deal more. He wasn't a man who ever complained about anything, so he didn't whine or whinge about his sad childhood, but he was raised by his grandparents. His own parents were caught up in a dreadful divorce, which really, I think, was such a terrible thing for a four-year-old to be taken to court and hear the judge declare his parents guilty of moral turpitude. And he adored his mother, but she went off and left him. And custody was given to his grandparents to bring him up. His grandparents were wonderful people, and he was very much loved by them. And his grandfather was an attorney and the postmaster of this little town in California called Santa Maria, which was storybook sort of perfect town of picket fences and wooden houses and lovely colors and everyone knowing each other and a very mixed sort of population, an artistic place, it sounds. And he was brought up in a very musical house, too, because there's a lot of history of musicians in the family. His aunt and uncle played professionally, and his great-grandfather was called strangely biblically Ithmar Konki sang with Jenny Lind, and he built the organ in the little church around the corner in New York, and he wrote a hymn that they're still playing in American churches now called Rathbun. So any musician that was in the town of Santa Maria would come and visit the house. So my father grew up surrounded by music, and he had a beautiful voice.
You mentioned some of the issues that he had, and really he could be excused for having abandonment issues. Were these all discoveries that you made in researching the book?
Yes. I had wonderful letters. He had one other child. He was married four times, and he had a child to his childhood sweetheart. They got married when he was rather young, and they had a baby girl called Mickey, and I didn't meet her until I traveled to California to work, and she lived in Claremont, and we became very close. And after my father died, we were made aware of all of these letters that Mickey had kept. She'd written to my father as she grew up. She was really hungry to know about her family on that side, and she never spent very much time with my father. The divorce happened when she was a toddler. And then my father, after a few years in California, sailed for Australia. So she would write to him and ask him about the family history and about his early life. And she was very frank, and he was very frank. So I had access to all of those letters. And it was incredibly helpful to understand what my father had gone through in the years before he became a singer.
Yes, it's very sad, isn't it? I mean, for different reasons, but after your father having all that abandonment from his parents, and then his grandmother died, and he finished up being brought up by his auntie, then with his own daughter, he didn't see her for, some 40 years.
Yes, he tried to get custody of her, but that didn't happen. And it was only when I was working over in California that he came over and we all were together and he saw his grandchildren for the first time. One sadness that happened was that he went back to Santa Maria, and because they had discovered oil wells surrounding the town, the whole place has been completely changed and it's all concreted and shopping malls, and the house of his grandparents has been demolished, and the beautiful gardens and hay and barn with the hay loft and all that sort of thing, gone. Everything gone. So he was very sad to see the town so changed. But it was wonderful for him to be with his eldest daughter.
Well, he did have some losses during his life. I mean, he lost his own name in about 1938, I think, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He gave it up. But, that was all due to wife number two. And it was a scandalous divorce case. She left Lloyd Bacon, who was a very prominent, the most successful director in Hollywood. She left him for my father. My father said he was a lamb to the slaughter. He was much younger than she was, and she just fell very heavily for this handsome young singer. And I don't think he understood what he was getting into, because he was singing at the Palomar. He'd come back to the West Coast. He wanted to get to New York. He actually wanted to be a serious concert singer. But he was doing extremely well when he got to the St. Francis Hotel where he was singing in San Francisco. He was written up as the brightest young star and kicking ether dust in all of the other singers' faces and, you know, sharing columns alongside Frank Sinatra and all that sort of thing. Anyway, when Ruby told Lloyd that she was leaving him, he contrived to wreck my father's career, because one night seeing it at the Palomar, it was a huge two-block, beautiful sort of dance and dinner venue. So Benny Goodman was the last act before my father came with his band. And in the middle of one of my father's songs, in front of thousands of people, two policemen walked up onto the stage, interrupted the song, put handcuffs on my father, and took him out to the police van and put him into the prison for the night. This had been contrived by Bacon to embarrass my father to the point where his career would be lost, because on the front pages of the paper next day it said, "Crooner arrested in film love case." And it was all to do with my father not turning up at the lawyer's office, which was a contrived case. So my father countersued, and again, that was in the paper. And then Ruby's demands in court were so outrageous during the Depression. She wanted money for servants and clothes and makeup, and it was just right across the country a scandal. And my father was involved in this awful mess, which eventually meant that after some years of this court case that went on and on and on, an agent said to him, "Bob, you've got to change your name." He was called Robert Cutter. And I think he looked out the window and saw Brooks Brothers. He said he got the name from Brooks Brothers, the haberdasher in America. So that's how he became Laurie Brooks and sailed for Australia on a world tour that was going to end up in New York, but he never left Australia.
Yes, he was. He even had the Hollywood scandals, and certainly was a big star. We've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song, and I'm very excited about the song you've picked, Darlene. Could you tell us a bit about it?
Well, I have a lot of songs of my father's, and some remind me of my childhood when he sings "Somewhere Over the Rainbow." They're all from the radio shows and from the 75s that he cut, and they've all been sent down to Canberra to be preserved. But when I only recently was sent this song, and I was so thrilled to get it because he sang this in 1957, and he was 50 at the time, and his career was coming to an end, and yet he seems to be really hitting his stride, and it conjures all of the glamour and the chutzpah of my father up on stage, so I love it.
So this is "Peg of My Heart" by Laurie Brooks with the Jim Gussie Orchestra from 1957.
A half hour of music attuned to the times. The band got away to a flying start with "Easy Now," and the easy vocal manner of our first guest, Laurie Brooks, takes us smoothly further into the program. Laurie has gone a long way back to select his number, but I don't think anyone's going to quarrel with the choice. It's "Peg of My Heart." In a whirl over one little girl. I love her, I love her, yes I do. Although her heart is far away, I hope to make her mine one day. Every flower that grows, every violet knows, I love her, I love her, yes I do. As I gaze in her eyes.
of blue, sweet eyes of blue, my darling peg of my heart, I love you, we'll never part. I love you, dear little girl, sweet little girl, sweeter than the rose of Erin, are your winning charms endearing, peg of my heart. Your glances with Irish eyes,
great stuff, a streamlined program of 1957.
We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And that was Peg of My Heart by Laurie Brooks with the Jim Gussie Orchestra, recorded in 1957, and it was chosen for us today by a special guest, Darlene Bungie, who is the author of Daddy Cool, Finding My Father, the singer who swapped Hollywood fame for home in Australia. Darlene, your father did have that Hollywood fame. How big a star was he?
In America? Well, he was a huge star here, arguably the most popular singer on radio after the war. And he composed songs too. But when he came out with the big band on this world tour with Jay Whiddon and singing at the Palais in Melbourne and the Tivoli, he did lots of sort of shows all over the country and went to New Zealand. He became very ill. And while he was in hospital, he was told by other members of the band that the manager had absconded with all of their money, so they were all stranded in Australia. My father's reputation was of such merit that Jim Davidson, who was the great band leader in Australia at the time, immediately employed my father once he was well and fit. He was in an Adelaide hospital for months. And so he had a wonderful time with Jim Davidson and the orchestra and felt that he hadn't ever been with such an inspiring group of musicians, and that he was improving all the time being with these musicians. And I think he loved the Australian camaraderie. He loved the humour. And I think what it was that he missed, you know, his father's company, and I think he loved all the male company in Australia at the time. And when the war broke out and America didn't join, he thought Hitler was evil incarnate, and he contrived to join the Australian army by telling a white lie and saying he was Canadian. And so he joined with Jim Davidson and two other musicians, and they formed an entertainment group that was the first of its kind. It grew and grew and grew, and there were many such entertainment units, but they were the number one concert party. And for 4 years, he sang in Europe and in New Guinea and sang to about 80,000 soldiers all in all.
Well, he joined the RAF in June 41, and at the time, Australia was at risk of invasion from the Japanese, but he really had no thought of going back to the US?
Well, no, I think he loved the musicians that he was working with, and I think he'd already fallen in love with Australia, but the war was utmost in his mind, and he wanted to join forces and fight Hitler. And so he did it the way he knew how, by taking some hope into the battlefields and entertaining the troops. So they followed the first people into Alamein, and then they stayed in, they, you know, would set up their stages in anywhere, in the middle of the desert, just, you know, by the car and sing and whatever, or in New Guinea, in the mud, or they'd put up the big stage and sing to thousands and thousands of men sitting in the rain and the mud. It must have been extraordinary, and in the middle of summer there, performances, they'd be bombed and they'd have to all seek shelter. I think during those years in the army, he became Australian. I don't think he ever wanted to go back after that.
And I guess all those audiences contributed, but I think you estimated that in the course of his lifetime, he performed to over 1 million people.
Over 2 million people. And he was always performing live, you know, singing on the radio shows. They'd have live audiences all the time. And that's another thing that I understood for the first time. Why, you know, his problem with alcohol, he was a shy man. So to get the courage, you know, to go on must have been a lot of adrenaline. And then he was always scared that he'd forget the lyrics. He could always juggle the music. He was a composer and a fine musician, but the lyrics sometimes he was afraid. So he'd have a little notebook with all the lyrics. But then to hit those high notes, you know, to go for those high notes, I'd never really appreciated how terrifying that must be when it's live, just in case you don't make it.
Yeah. Towards the end of the story, I mean, the beginning of the story for you, but when he met your mother, she was coming up as his fourth wife. He had three disasters. Do you think your
third wife left him while he was in the army? She got sort of restless and went off with somebody else while he was in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think that's happened to quite a few soldiers and probably still happening. But do you think your mother knew the whole story that you've now put together?
Oh, she did. Yes. My father was always very honest and frank, and he would never have not exposed his roller coaster life. And he said that they caught the tram from Martin Place and it trundled all the way up to her family home where she was living at the time, to Vaucluse. And it took all that time to unravel his domino fall of blackness, you know, all of his bad luck. And at the end, he asked her if she'd marry him, and she said yes, and changed his bad luck to good luck, because she was the love of his life. And I don't know what would have happened to him. His friends told my mother that he would have, you know, killed himself with alcohol or, you know, get into bar fights. He was a loose cannon until she came along.
Well, you'd have to say he believed in marriage, because he went there four times.
He was a romantic and an optimist, yes. You know, he was a thorough gentleman too, despite the string of disastrous marriages. In his American idiom, he once said to me, oh, it was in a letter to me, he said, I never wolfed. I always waited for the woman to make the first move.
You said he never complained about much, but do you think he did have any regrets in that long life?
I think he probably regretted Ruby. He never spoke. She was such a bombshell. He never complained. The one time that he ever mentioned this enormous life that he used to have, full of money and glamour and adulation, my sister was applying for a scholarship to Columbia University in America, and by this time my father had, you know, taken a job as a proofreader, which he had all through my growing up and even after. He loved words, and he was a good writer, and he was a wonderful proofreader, and he proofed this letter for her and handed it back and said, there was a time when I was much more than a proofreader. Mm. And that's the only time my sister and I have ever heard him express anything about this past life that he gave up for a family in the suburbs.
Yeah, it's such an extraordinary story, because he did have the life that some of us aspire to, the fame and the excitement and the performing and all the rest of it, but that he really found his happiness in that with the woman he loved and his children. You know, I'm sure that you and your sister and Mickey eventually formed a big part of that happiness that he got later in life.
Oh, absolutely, and he wrote about that. There was no question about that. And I think, you know, for my mother too, her father abandoned her. She never saw him. He lived in the same city. He left when she was a babe in arms. They both were longing for a family and the security of a house that they, you know, owned. And they managed to do that. It was great happiness for them. I was 12 years old by the time they managed to own a house. And, you know, it's remarkable that that's all that they wanted. And they loved their child. We were such lucky girls to have such parents.
The story, it's like a mosaic with all these different parts, and but it's wonderful to have that record and for everyone else to be able to share in that extraordinary life. So thank you very much, Darlene, for writing this story. I might just remind you, everyone, it's called Daddy Cool, Finding My Father, the singer who swapped Hollywood fame for home in Australia. And look, there are lots more stories in the book, but we're running out of time, so... Can I give a very special thank you to Darlene Bungie, the author of Daddy Cool? Thank you, Darlene, for being on Dad's on the Air.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
So don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter.
And just before we go, we might listen to a little bit more of that golden voice of Laurie Brooks.
And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.
Charms endearing, peg of my heart. Your glances with Irish art entrance us. Come be my own, come make your home in my heart. My head's in a whirl over one little girl. I love her, I love her, yes I do. Although her heart is far away, I hope to make her mine one day.